You ever get that feeling, you know, when some huge financial event blows up and you're just trying to wrap your head around it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, what really just happened?
Exactly. And you wish you had a clearer picture of, well, the deeper forces at work. We've all been there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Especially thinking back to, say, 2008.
Oh, definitely. That was a big one.
So today, we're not just going to rehash what happened back then. We want to dig into the fundamental why. And we're doing that with a really interesting lens. George Soros's book, The New Paradigm for Financial Markets.
Which is quite something because he published it right in 2008 as things were really hitting the fan.
Get ready for some pretty surprising insights, I think. Stuff that might actually shift how you view the whole financial world.
It's a fascinating read, or, well, listen for our deep dive today. Soros basically argues that the standard economic thinking of the time,
The equilibrium stuff.
yeah, exactly, the
Yeah.
idea that markets naturally find a stable balance, he argues it just completely failed, couldn't predict it, couldn't explain the chaos afterwards.
So what's his alternative?
His big idea, the core of it all, is what he calls the theory of reflexivity. And that's really key to understanding his whole argument.
Okay, reflexivity. Let's break that down a bit. What does that actually mean in simple terms?
Think of it like a two-way street, or maybe a feedback loop between what market participants believe is happening or going to happen and the actual situation in the market.
So it's not just us reacting to prices.
No, it's more than that. Our reactions, our buying and selling based on our beliefs, they actually change the market. Our perceptions don't just mirror reality, they actively shape it.
Ah, okay. So it feeds back on itself.
Precisely. And this creates these feedback loops, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. They can push prices really far away from, any sort of fundamental value,
Leading to.
leading to these boom bust cycles, or what Soros specifically calls super bubbles, these really long-term cycles.
And he saw 2008 as one of those.
Exactly. He argues the 2008 crash was the bursting of a massive super bubble, one that had been inflated for decades, really, by huge credit expansion and this powerful belief in free markets doing no wrong.
Market fundamentalism, he calls it, right?
That's the term he uses. And he puts the US housing bubble right at the center of that particular super bubble implosion.
So this isn't just some abstract theory, then. Let's talk about Soros himself. Who is he, and why should we, listen to his take on this?
Right, good question. He's definitely not just an academic. He's, well, famously a hugely successful hedge fund manager, made billions in the
The
markets.
man who broke the Bank of England, that story.
That's the one. But he also calls himself a failed philosopher, which I think tells you a lot about his intellectual ambition. He thinks deeply about these
And the
things.
background.
His personal history is pretty intense. He survived the Nazi occupation of Hungary as a teenager. He credits his father's ingenuity and, frankly, rule bending during that time as a massive influence on his thinking about survival and navigating flawed systems.
Wow, okay. That's bound to shape your worldview.
Absolutely. Then later, he studied economics at the London School of Economics under Karl Popper, actually. And even back then, he started questioning the standard assumptions.
Like what?
Like the idea that everyone in the market has perfect knowledge or acts perfectly rationally. He explored these ideas about reflexivity way back in his earlier book, The Alchemy of Finance.
So he's got this mix of hardcore market experience and, well, philosophical thinking.
Exactly, a pretty unique blend. He's looking at markets from both the inside as a player and from the outside as a critic of the theories about markets.
Okay, so for someone listening now, maybe trying to make sense of today's markets, why go back to Soros in 2008? What's the relevance?
Well, because the fundamental point he makes that financial markets have this built-in instability, this tendency towards booms and busts driven by our own beliefs and actions.
That hasn't gone away.
Not at all. Understanding reflexivity and how misconceptions can drive markets gives you a really powerful framework. It's not just about understanding 2008, it's about spotting potential risks and vulnerabilities today.
So it's a tool for thinking critically.
Definitely. For you, the listener, the learner, it's a way to get beyond those sort of simplified textbook models pretty quickly. It helps you grasp how markets really work, warts and all.
Questioning the headlines, maybe.
Yeah, questioning the dominant narratives, looking for those self-feeding trends, those underlying beliefs that might be, well, flawed, beliefs that could be setting us up for the next bump in the road, or maybe something bigger.
Okay, so let's dig back into reflexivity. Can you give us maybe a clearer example? How does it work in practice?
Sure. Let's take the stock market example he uses.
Yeah.
Traditional economics might say a stock's price reflects its, underlying value, earnings, assets, future prospects, that kind of thing. It gravitates towards an equilibrium price.
Right. Based on fundamentals.
But reflexivity says, hold on. Investors' expectations about a stock's future price heavily influence its current price.
How so?
Well, if lots of people suddenly believe a stock is going way up, maybe because of some new story or just momentum,
They start buying.
That demand pushes the price up, which then seems to confirm the initial belief that it was going up.
The feedback loop again.
Exactly. It reinforces itself. Even if the company's actual fundamental situation hasn't really changed all that much, the perception starts driving the reality.
So it can become kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, for a while at least, driven by sentiment.
Precisely. And Soros really stresses that these beliefs, these expectations, they aren't always rational or based on perfect data. Far from it. There's bias, there's herd behavior, there's simple misunderstanding.
Which means the price can get seriously out of whack with reality.
Seriously out of whack. And that gap, that disconnect, is where the instability, the uncertainty creeps in, or rather, it's inherent. Financial markets, in his view, aren't like these efficient machines finding the true price.
They're more human.
Messy.
More like a historical process, yeah. Shaped by these shifting, often flawed human perceptions. Which is why he really disagreed with things like the rational expectations theory.
The idea that everyone, on average, figures it out correctly.
Yeah, the idea that the market somehow aggregates all information perfectly and rationally. Soros thought that was just plain wrong, especially in finance.
Okay, and this idea, reflexivity, is the engine behind his super bubble hypothesis. How does that link work?
Right, so the super bubble is like reflexivity playing out over the very long term. You have a dominant trend in the run-up to 2008 that was decades of credit expansion, more and more borrowing.
Uh-huh.
And that trend interacts with a dominant misconception or a flawed belief.
Which was?
Market fundamentalism. This deep-seated belief that markets, if left alone, are inherently stable and self-correcting. Laissez-faire on steroids, basically.
Okay.
And Soros argues that previous crises, like, say, the 1998 long-term capital management crisis or earlier international banking scares, they actually reinforced the misconception. How? Because the system didn't totally collapse.
Exactly. Each time authorities stepped in, things stabilized, and it seemed like, okay, the system works, the market handled it. But Soros says these were like successful tests that just allowed the underlying trend, the credit expansion, and the flawed belief to continue, even grow stronger.
So each save just made the underlying problem bigger for next time.
That's the idea. The divergence between the belief in stable markets and the reality of growing leverage and risk just got wider and wider until 2008.
And that was the breaking point.
That was the point where, in his view, both the trend of endless credit growth and the misconception of market perfection finally became unsustainable. The super bubble burst.
Got it. So the U.S. housing bubble fits into this as, the main event within the super bubble.
Precisely. It was the most visible, most dramatic manifestation of these bigger forces.
How did reflexivity play out specifically there in housing?
Well, you had that environment of easy credit, the market fundamentalist belief that regulation wasn't needed, and then you saw this aggressive relaxation of lending standards.
The subprime mortgages we heard so much about.
Subprime, yes. Loans to people with shaky credit, but also AIR-OMS adjustable rate mortgages with those low teaser rates that would jump up later.
I remember those.
LIR loans, NINJA loans, no income, no job or assets. It got pretty crazy. Loan-to-value ratios just kept climbing.
And the reflexive part was?
The core belief. Housing prices only go up. Forever, apparently.
Right.
That belief fueled everything. Borrowers thought, worst case, I sell the house for more. Lenders thought, the collateral value is rising. What's the risk? It created this massive demand for mortgages and a willingness to supply them almost regardless of the borrower's ability to actually repay long term.
Everyone assuming the music wouldn't stop.
Pretty much. And crucially, Soros points out the misconception that the value of the collateral of the house was somehow independent of the willingness to lend.
Ah, but the easy lending was actually pushing prices up.
Exactly. The lending standards created the price appreciation, which then seemed to justify the lending standards. Classic reflexive loop.
And then came the financial engineering on top of it all.
Oh, yeah. Securitization mania. Taking all these mortgages, bundling them up into collateralized debt obligations, CDOs.
Slicing and dicing the risks.
Supposedly. They sliced them into different tranches, saying some were super safe, AAA rated, but it all depended on the underlying mortgages getting paid.
Which was becoming less likely.
Increasingly unlikely. Then it got even more complex CDO squareds, which were CDOs made up of other CDO tranches, synthetic CDOs.
My head hurts already.
Right. And then credit default swaps, CDSs, basically insurance policies on whether these bonds would default.
Right.
The market for CDSs exploded. The face value of CDS contracts ended up being many times larger than the actual value of the bonds they were supposedly insuring. It was a house of cards built on leverage and obscured risk.
And fueled by fees, presumably.
Hugely. Everyone involved, the originators, the bundlers, the rating agencies, the sellers, was making money based on the volume of these things being created and traded, not necessarily on their long-term quality or safety. Big incentive problem.
Soros must have seen the warning signs, like those teaser rates resetting.
He definitely points to things like that. He argues it should have been obvious that many borrowers simply couldn't afford the payments once the initial low rates expired. The writing was on the wall, but the reflexive momentum kept the game going.
So when did he pinpoint the actual turn? When did the error start coming out?
He flags August 2007 as really critical. That's when the problems that had been simmering in subprime really started to spill over and freeze up the wider credit markets.
What happened then?
You had American Home Mortgage, a big lender, go bankrupt. And then BNP Paribas, a major European bank, suddenly froze withdrawals from some investment funds because they couldn't value the subprime assets inside them.
The we don't know what this stuff is worth moment.
Exactly. That sent shockwaves. Trust just evaporated. Before that, you'd seen Bear Stearns having trouble with some of its mortgage hedge funds in June and other lenders faltering earlier in the year. But August was when it became clear this wasn't contained. The whole system was connected. And it was fragile.
The beginning of the end, really.
The beginning of the rapid unraveling, yeah. The liquidity freeze showed the party was over.
Okay, stepping back a bit, what are some of the practical things listeners can take away from Soros's analysis? How does this help us navigate things now?
Well, first, I think it encourages a healthy dose of skepticism. Skepticism about claims of market perfection, or that markets always get it right on their own.
Don't just trust the narrative.
Right. Question the underlying assumptions. Be aware that strong beliefs, especially widely shared ones, can actually create their own reality for a while, potentially leading to bubbles.
And second?
Second, understanding reflexivity helps you spot potential warning signs. Look for areas where you see maybe rapid credit growth happening alongside a really strong, almost unquestioned story about why prices have to keep going up.
Like this time it's different.
Exactly that kind of thinking. Recognizing those feedback loops, rising prices, justifying more borrowing, which pushes prices higher, can make you a more discerning observer, maybe a more cautious investor, too.
It's really about seeing that interplay between the numbers and the psychology, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And even though he wrote this about 2008, the principles are timeless. Are there sectors today seeing huge growth fueled by easy money and a belief in, you know, endless upside? Soros' framework gives you a lens to analyze that kind of situation critically.
Makes sense. What about Soros' own motivation? Why write this book right in the middle of the storm? What was he trying to do?
Yeah, it's interesting timing. I think beyond just explaining the crisis, he had a deeper goal. He really wanted to show how his theory of reflexivity offered a better way to understand how markets actually work compared to the standard equilibrium models he thought were failing.
So it was partly an I told you so, or maybe here's why this is happening.
A bit of both, maybe. By publishing it in real time, he was making a strong case. Look, the dynamics I've been talking about for decades, this crisis is proof they're real and powerful. It was a validation of his intellectual framework.
And maybe a warning.
And definitely a warning about sticking to that flawed market fundamentalist paradigm. I also suspect he felt a kind of responsibility, given his unique position, both a theorist and a massively successful practitioner, to share his insights during such a critical period.
Like a doctor diagnosing a patient mid-crisis using his own special tools.
That's a good analogy. And in doing that, he wasn't just explaining the past or present. He was offering a way to think about the future, too.
Now, Soros didn't just diagnose, did he? He also had some thoughts on what should be done. Policy-wise, back in early 2008.
He did. Even as things were unfolding, he was already calling for specific actions. big focus on increasing transparency and regulation, especially for those complex derivatives like CDOs and CDSs that had obscured so much risk.
Make things less opaque.
Exactly. Get them onto exchanges, regulate them properly. He also strongly argued for measures to prevent unnecessary foreclosures.
Helping homeowners.
Yeah, trying to stabilize the housing market by keeping people in their homes where possible. He understood that mass foreclosures would just crater house prices further and devastate communities. He even put his own money into efforts like that through his philanthropy later on.
And what was his general outlook then in early 08? Did he see the full extent of it?
He was definitely pessimistic. He predicted the end of what he saw as a 60-year supercycle of credit expansion. He thought this crisis would be much more severe and longer lasting than previous downturns.
More so than, say, the LTCM crisis.
Much more so. He also saw constraints on the Federal Reserve's ability to just cut interest rates endlessly because he worried about the value of the U.S. dollar.
International factors.
Right. He saw the potential for a reversal of financial deregulation trends, too. Interestingly, while he foresaw a U.S. recession, he thought the global economy might avoid one, thanks to growth in places like China, India, and oil-exporting countries.
That part didn't quite pan out that way, did it?
Well, the global impact ended up being severe, but the decoupling idea was quite common then. He also shared his own investment stance at the time, basically short U.S. and European stocks, U.S. bonds, and the dollar, while being long emerging markets and other currencies. Shows his willingness to put his money where his mouth is.
He certainly wasn't shy about sharing his views or even his trades. It gives the book a certain directness.
Absolutely. He has a very direct, sometimes quite critical tone, especially towards the economic theories and the authorities he felt had failed. But sharing his own calls, successes, and failures adds a layer of, well, authenticity. It's not just theory from an ivory tower.
Okay, so for listeners who've found this chat interesting and maybe want to explore Soros' ideas more, what's the next step?
Well, the obvious first step is to check out The New Paradigm for Financial Markets itself. Reading his own words in the context of when he wrote them is really illuminating.
Get it straight from the source.
Definitely. And beyond that, digging into the concept of reflexivity more broadly, maybe his earlier book, The Alchemy of Finance, or other articles and discussions about it, it's a powerful idea that applies beyond just finance, really, to politics, social trends.
Any situation where beliefs and reality influence each other.
Pretty much.
All right, so let's wrap up with a final thought. Soros called for a new paradigm back in 2008. If we apply his lens, reflexivity, superbubbles, market fundamentalism to the world today, what's maybe one big question or potential risk area he might point to? Something for our listeners to chew on.
That's a great question. Given his focus on credit, belief systems, and hidden risks, I suspect he might look very closely at areas where there's been, again, significant debt buildup combined with maybe overly optimistic or widespread assumptions.
Like where, potentially?
Could be certain tech valuations, perhaps aspects of private credit, maybe even government debt levels in some places. Anywhere you see leverage combined with a strong narrative that seems to dismiss downside risk, the it can only go up mentality again.
So look for the intersection of easy money and strong belief.
I think that would be his starting point. He'd urge us to constantly question, what's the dominant trend? What's the dominant misconception? And how are they feeding each other right now? Where are the hidden reflexive dynamics at play? It's about staying intellectually vigilant, really.
A lot to think about there. Some really valuable insights. Thanks for breaking it all down.
My pleasure. It's fascinating stuff.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in to this deep dive. Hopefully it's given you a fresh perspective on the forces shaping our financial world. We will pop some links to George Soros's book and more info on reflexivity into our show notes if you want to explore further.
Definitely worth checking out.
Until next time, keep digging deeper.